This is the Improved Photography Podcast, episode number 159. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Improved Photography Podcast. I'm your host, Jim Harmer, and I am joined by Mr. Nick Page and Jeff Harmon. Hey, guys, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having
me. Thank you.
Well, today we are talking about a lot of different topics, but first we want to get to our question of the week from Alan, who asked on our Facebook group, I'm thinking of branching out from printing merely on paper to printing on canvas and metal. Canvas seems pretty straightforward, but how can one tell if a photo will look good on metal short of ordering in it? Basically, he doesn't want to spend the money on a metal print until he's sure that a metal print is actually going to look good. So, Nick, what are kind of your criteria when you're deciding on that?
So, I've found that because metal is so reflective, that any photos that are kind of on the dark side, a dark, moody shot, you're going to end up losing a lot of the detail just because of the reflection off of the metal. So a dark photo doesn't work so good on metal. The brighter photos, however, look great. And then there's the whole issue of like, how much detail do I care about? Some photos I prefer to print on canvas because it's not texture oriented. It's not, the texture isn't a really important part of the image. So those shots I will print on canvas. But if it's something that I really care about the textures and the finer details, I really like how those look on metal. Bright images look great on metal. Highly textured images look great on metal. Darker images don't do so hot on metal.
Yeah, the way that I might put it is that if your photo relies on contrast, if you need those deep blacks for the photo to really even just work, metal's a bad idea because metal does not have deep blacks because of that reflective kind of quality that you were talking about, Nick. Mm-hmm. Colors do really well on metal. I mean, they'll really shine, literally. And so they'll work quite well. But that doesn't mean that you can't print black and whites on metal, because black and whites usually do rely on that contrast. But I have a couple black and whites that I printed on metal for my wife for the nursery, because we have a baby coming in July. And so for the nursery, I printed some really big metal prints of my first two kids when they were newborn babies to put in the nursery, and they look awesome. Mm-hmm. Really, really good in black and white. So I don't know. I wouldn't say that you're going to ever order a print on metal and just say, blah, that just looks terrible. But there are definitely times that one is a little bit better or worse, depending on the situation.
Right. And having said that about the reflective quality of it, you can get like a matte finish metal print. I think Adorama print, Picks does those. But
I haven't seen that.
Right. And you just lose so much contrast with it that it's kind of like, meh. But Bay Photo, they actually have the best looking metal print as far as, if you're worried about the reflective quality of it. So say you have a kind of a darker image that the reflections will really kill the dark parts of the image. They have a medium gloss option. And some of my favorite metal prints have been done on that medium gloss because they're not nearly as reflective. So that's an option as well.
What about considering how it's going to be hung up?
You know, if you know what room it's going into, which, like, when I print stuff, like, I have no idea where it's going to end up. I just print it and hope it sells. But if you know the room that it's going into, you can guess what's going to look best in there. Some rooms that are going to have lots of glare, maybe canvas would be a better option. A really dark room, canvas would probably be a better option. But if you have a nice, bright, airy room where reflections aren't going to be as big a deal, I would say that would be a good case for metal.
Yeah, the other thing that I would say is that if you have to consider not just the way that the print itself is going to look, but also just the kind of feeling that the print is going to give. And a metal photo is going to give a really modern look to a room. And so if it's in a real classic home, my parents just asked me to make a print and put it above the mantle in their home. And you just wouldn't want metal. It just doesn't match their house. Their house is very classic old people nice looking. And so they wouldn't want that above their mantle. It's just, it would just look weird. Mm-hmm. And likewise, I would say a canvas just isn't a match for that kind of situation. I think just a traditional framed print is going to look the best over the mantle, at least in their house. So each photo has a little bit of a different feeling. It's rare that you're going to get one that just looks horrible for the photo, depending on, you know, what medium you choose. But I do think that those nuances are things to pay attention to.
Mm-hmm.
All right. The second question comes from Michael Humber, who asks, I recall this being discussed before, but I did a search and nothing popped up. Does anyone know of free software to recover deleted files from a flash card? Jeff, I'm sure you know of some utilities that could be useful in this situation. But I will say, I always keep those little slips of paper when I buy a memory card, because both Lexar and SanDisk, when you buy their pro level cards, they'll give you a little tiny little slip of paper, like fortune cookie size, and it has the code you'll need to download their software to recover photos from the flash card. And it doesn't, you know, the Lexar one will work on a SanDisk card, etc. Sure. Right. It's just it's, I think, really good software. So if you can't find one, email me at jim@improvephotography.com and I'll send you one of mine. Michael, if you need help. I can't send one to all many, many thousands of you, but Michael, if you email me, I'll send you one. But Jeff, have you found any free ones?
So I have looked into it a little bit before, and they don't focus so much on the, there's utilities to go and do recovery of hard drives. Even that, though, there's not great free ones. They're really not user-friendly. You have to be like very technically inclined to understand how to use them. So my advice to anybody, even if they don't have one, and if they're having trouble with a card, it's not that much money just to go buy a card, just to get the code so you can go download the software and use it, rather than going and licensing some other software. Just go buy a new card and use that. I buy them every time they're on sale. So I just barely, last week, Amazon had a good sale on Lexar SD cards. I got another 32 gig one, and I made sure to keep the little pamphlet. So Lexar has a pamphlet inside that has a code on the pamphlet for the software, and I just keep that. I throw the box away, but I keep that. And then SanDisk, it's something that I'll bet all of you have just thrown away. It's on the inside, a sticker stuck to the back of the box on the inside. So you really need to make sure you don't tear the box in half at the midpoint. You need to kind of tear it at the top, and then you separate the back off. You can just kind of tear the box so that you only have the code. Keep that. Or what I've been doing actually is just taking a picture of it with my iPhone, and then I keep that picture around and throw everything away, and I'll have the code should I need it at some point.
That makes a lot more sense than like putting them in little tiny frames and hanging them on your wall or something like that. Keeping a whole bunch of creepy little cardboard codes everywhere, I think.
Well, and the thing I worried about, because I had them on my office desk here, but every once in a while the wife will come in and she'll help me clean up my office.
Help you.
And those end up in the trash. Yeah. Yeah. So
why would she think that little pieces of cardboard is trash? That's just
torn apart cardboard. Yeah.
Yeah. She should know better.
Ridiculous. Well, one big news item that came out this week is Adobe released a new version of Lightroom and Photoshop. And there were some, I guess, minor to moderate changes in Lightroom that should be hitting on some of the things that we were hoping that they would hit on with performance. But I've downloaded it and only spent a little bit of time there, Jeff. You've probably spent more time with it. It just came out yesterday, but I can't find any big noticeable differences. Am I missing something?
So yesterday being the 27th, yeah, that's when it was released. And I was hoping that Adobe would not worry about a whole bunch of new features, because I want them to worry about performance and stability of the application. The stability is not so bad, but the performance has been really bad. We've talked a lot about that, and did work on some of that this time according to the release notes. So let's go over kind of the one feature that they added was something for panoramas. It's called the Panorama Merge Boundary Wrap. And so what that is when you stitch together your panoramic shots, it often will have kind of a perspective where you lose some of the sky or some of the foreground, and it doesn't, because it doesn't all align well. You have two choices. You can either crop the resulting pano, or you can kind of warp the edges, or you can take it. I guess there's three choices, because you can also in Photoshop try to do some content aware fill to fill that in. And any of those solutions are pretty good. But what Lightroom's trying to do, or the feature they're adding in here, is trying to auto warp those edges so that you end up with a nice, clean, square panorama photo. It will figure out how to warp the edges to make that work. And my testing, it's also much faster. The stitching itself is much faster. It was supposed to be much faster. So I've done some testing.
So just to be clear on this, what I usually do is when I merge a panorama together and you get kind of those weird edges everywhere, is I'll usually select them in Photoshop and I'll content aware fill those little spots so that it just kind of fills that out. And it works, I mean, beautifully, like almost every time. That works for me, unless there's, you know, something weird, a tree on the edge that it can't get quite right. But unfortunately, if I'm to understand this right, and I haven't spent a lot of time with it, you could probably answer this, but it sounds like, from the name of it at least, Boundary Warp, what they're doing is they're not filling those extra spots. They're just stretching the pixels around that edge to fill out the extra spot. Yep. And so it's making things look weird that it's stretching from. Is that right?
Yeah, it's literally just like the warp tool inside of Photoshop. If you used that to try to repair them, and sometimes that works okay. Sometimes that works pretty well. You can take a sky and warp it and not have it look funny, as long as you only get the sky part that you're trying to warp, if you don't include the rest of it. So there's ways that can work really well. And that's what this is trying to automatically do for you. I've tried it under a bunch of stuff. So I went snowshoeing last week and I took my camera and I took a bunch of panoramas. I didn't even know Lightroom's coming out. It's just, I shoot a lot of panoramas anyway. And so I hadn't imported them and used them yet. So this was a great test case for it, for not only this, but the other performance features I'll get to in a second. And what I've discovered is it really kind of likes multi-row panoramas. So not where you're going from left to right and you take maybe 3, 4, or 5 pictures just straight in one line, but where you might take 3 across and then go down and do another 3 and down and another 3, something like that, multi-row panorama. It seemed to do a really good job with that. But the single row panoramas, it struggles, especially in places where you want to have a horizon that is straight. Mm-hmm. The warp kind of is being applied to the whole thing, and it makes those horizons not be straight anymore, and it doesn't work very well. So there's that. It is faster, though. I timed it between the merges. I did it multiple times with different sets, and I did it before I upgraded and after, because I knew that was supposed to be a feature, and it was about twice as fast, especially with the multi-row panoramas.
Nice. I had a chance to play with this literally for like a half hour before we recorded, so I've used it a lot. Really familiar with it. I stitched one panorama, and I did notice that it seemed a little faster, and twice as fast, I'll take that. That's nice. Anytime you can speed something up by that much, it's awesome. But I was really skeptical about the whole like automatic warp thing. So I tried it on the one panorama that I had available to me at the moment, and it actually worked pretty well. I went into it really skeptical. I was like, oh, this is just going to look so hokey. And it seemed to do fairly well. Granted, I didn't have a straight horizon line. I had no straight edges or straight lines in my photo. And that's where I think that this warp feature is going to really fall flat, is anytime you have anything straight in your image, that's when you're going to want to go over into Photoshop and either manually warp it, or more ideally, just do some content aware fill.
So then they had two other performance updates that are supposed to be in there. One has to do with previews, and it feels to me like Adobe's trying really hard to figure this out so that it will work better, because it's awful right now. The previews seem to add like almost no value unless you're going to take it like take your catalog mobile on a laptop, then there's value.
So for people who aren't sure what that is, tell us about the previews, what they're actually doing.
You have multiple choices. The main one that it does more automatically, it's like the default, is called a one-to-one preview. And that will, Lightroom will bring in your raw file. It will generate a preview that's it's analogous to a JPEG version of the image, so that it can show that and it can load that from its cache rather than having to go all the way out to that massive raw file. And if you generate those previews when you import, then you can actually, that cache of those previews can be on your hard drive, and you don't even need to have the actual raw file to do some work on editing your photos. It will have a JPEG-like, it's not exactly JPEG, but a JPEG-like version of the photo kind of cached off on your hard drive that's much smaller than the raw file. Then you can take your laptop with you and you can still do editing offline, sort of, is kind of the way that that's supposed to work. Outside of that, it's supposed to speed up other things too. It's supposed to speed up your being able to cull through the photos. It's supposed to speed up edits, even if you're zooming in. But really, I have found that that doesn't really help. I haven't even been generating them because I don't want to wait on import to generate them. So what they've added in this version is called preemptive building of one-to-one previews. So the idea is you don't have to do that on import anymore. They've got it fast enough now to where as you're going through the photos, it will, as you go to look at the photo, build the preview as you're looking at the photo, and it's fast enough that that can work well. So I tested this out. I imported the photos in the previous version and built the previews. It took forever. And then I went through them and I timed how long it took for me to get through the film strip of all your photos in the develop module. Just went from one to the next as fast as I could. As soon as the loading message on the develop module went away, I went to the next photo. Timed that, and then I deleted the cache that's on your hard drive where all these previews go, and I copied the photos over to a different directory and re-imported them, and did the same thing without building the previews, and the time was virtually the same. It didn't seem to be any different.
Now, from what I understand, these one-to-one previews, that's actually when you zoom in to one-to-one pixels, right? So like when you zoom in all the way, that's a one-to-one view that you're seeing, like 100% image that you're seeing there. I thought that the one-to-one previews are actually like when you zoom in and then you're looking around, it's going to generate that sharp version of the full resolution of your image faster. That's what I was under the impression that this was.
So, and that's, it's true. It's one-to-one means that you can zoom in and get all of the detail there. If you can choose some others, I can't remember what the names of them are. There's some smaller ones. Problem will be when you zoom in on those, they're going to look blurry, blocky, whatever, because they don't have all the detail. The one-to-one has it. But if the one-to-one's there, that's also what will be used for the other, even if you're not in one-to-one. Okay. It just means that the preview it did has enough resolution you can actually zoom into one-to-one.
Okay, gotcha.
So I don't know that there's any advantage there. I guess it did make it so that I didn't have to wait for the previews to be built. Now that I'm talking about it and thinking through it, I did skip that step. So the fact that it didn't seem to really impact how quickly I could get through the images, that is saying a lot, actually, now that I think about it, that could help. You don't have to waste the time building one-to-one previews on import. Okay. So that's cool.
Yeah, that was the first thing that I tested as soon as I saw the new update here, is I saw culling faster, and I was like, yes, that's exactly what I've been wanting. And so I immediately came to the computer and tried, and I don't feel any difference. You know, unscientific test, but I just didn't feel any difference at all in the culling speed. Maybe it's for, these updates apply to so many different people on different, you know, operating systems, different configurations of their computer and everything. So maybe for my configuration, it just didn't do much. And, you know, for a low powered computer, maybe it will be a big change.
True.
But for me, I just didn't feel any difference there. Which I was very sad about, because that was the biggest thing that I am really wanting to see from Adobe. I will say that I have gotten before the software before it was released so that we could talk about it on release date. Improved photography was cut out this time, presumably because we've been
pretty rough on Adobe lately. Yeah.
I got a little bit of a laugh about that. But you know, it's great software, but these updates keep saying performance, 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 and it's just not trickling down to the real life world for me.
The last one, I think you would say it. So go ahead, Nick.
I was going to say the good thing is they didn't really mess anything up.
Right.
And there's been releases where that's all they did was just mess it up and like add a dehaze slider.
Testaments to this release being just fine for everyone to install is the forums are completely empty. There is nobody complaining about anything on this release. So
golf clap right there. Exactly.
That's right. That is good. That's a really good sign. They're headed in the right direction. This is exactly how I wanted them to focus on things. And so maybe the fact that we're saying there's nothing to see here, that means that's really good. Yeah. There's nothing to see here. The one other performance update, thumbnails. As you go to copy and paste settings to your a whole bunch of images, especially in the develop module, if you're going to copy there, historically, I've noticed this a lot. The thumbnails don't update very fast. In fact, mm-hmm. a lot of them, if they're not in the immediate screen, if you scroll over in the film strip view down there at the bottom, those thumbnails are not even touched. And then when you let go of the scroll bar, it works for a few seconds there and goes and updates all the thumbnails. Now that seems to happen really, really fast. Very noticeable difference there on how that copy and paste and the thumbnails in the film strip get updated. Tiny thing. I don't think it was that big of a deal, but hey, I'll take it too.
Yeah, exactly. And that's probably the least useful thing they could have possibly done. Like that, you know, I've noticed that in the past, but I was never like, oh man, that just bothers me so much.
Right.
I just wish that they would speed up my thumbnails that are this big. Yeah.
Yeah. Agreed. But at least we're seeing that they're able to finally put some updates out that aren't killing things. So that's awesome.
Good job.
Well, that's good. Well, I have, as I mentioned last week on the podcast, I decided that this year I am going to be taking a lot more jobs locally here, starting from scratch, and with no portfolio, nothing, and just seeing if it's possible in 2016 to still earn money in the photography market. And the area that I'm going to focus on is real estate photography, because I really feel like there's a lot of untapped potential in real estate, you know, in weddings and senior portraits and babies and all that area. I definitely believe you can make money with it. There are definitely people starting businesses today and are succeeding at it, but there's a lot of competition as well. And with real estate photography, the barrier to entry is really low, at least in my market. It's a very low barrier to entry, looking at the other companies that are doing it. So I'm going to be taking on these jobs and sharing my experiences as I go and see if it's a viable place for people to earn a little side income or even start a real business doing real estate photography. So I mentioned last week that I got in contact with an old friend who's a real estate agent, and I just immediately scored a contract there that'll be about 100 houses during the year. And I didn't have any portfolio because my rule was I wanted to start from nothing. And so I had to quickly, I talked to him, I sent him a price list, and they're like, yeah, can we see any photos? And I was like,
nope.
No, you can't. Because I wanted to make it real that, you know, what it's really like for somebody to start a photography business and get going. And so I said, okay, well, I walked outside my house and I started taking pictures of it so that I could make a portfolio. Because I really wanted to start from scratch. And I have the original DJI Phantom, which just never really worked for actual still photos because it was just too jello-y. It just never worked quite right. And so I wanted to get the front exterior photo, but I wanted it from an elevated position. and my neighbor stole my paint pole. So I was like, great, no paint pole, no drone, but I've got to get an elevated photo and I need to send a whole portfolio today. So I got out on a ladder on and put it in the middle of my street. My new neighbors probably thought I was nutso. And I started taking pictures of the house. A ladder is a little bit too low for that elevated perspective, but it was definitely a nice benefit over, you know, just tripod height for one of these photos. And so it worked okay to get that perspective. And so I sent a few photos, just things that I could shoot right there. And I did something kind of cool. If you got the Lightroom Steel this year, you saw on the sales page, I had these things where it would show you the before photo and you could swipe to the right and see the after photo right there. And so I built a page with those so that they could see, you know, an ugly cell phone shot of this, what it looks like, and then swipe it to see what it could look like.
Cool. Nice.
It was actually pretty neat. And I think it was a good way to sell real estate photos because that's exactly what's going to happen.
Yeah.
If they don't hire a professional, it's going to be a real estate agent going and snapping with their cell phone. And so I think it really sold it. I got the contract, right? So it was interesting doing that. And then the next thing was I said, well, they said my first assignment is going to be photographing a more expensive home on several acres. And so I thought, yeah, the ladder isn't going to work for this one. And I've really been wanting this unique Typhoon H. That I've talked about several times on the podcast. I don't know. I'm going back and forth. I'm really excited about it because of the features that I've mentioned, but also I heard from quite a few people who own the unique drones already, and they did not have good things to say. And since I've got to start, I decided I'm not going to wait on the unique and guinea pig it and see if it's good. So I decided I'm just going to buy the DJI Phantom 3. It should be here tomorrow. I just heard from too many people shooting those unique drones that made me a little bit too wary. So we'll see what it's like. I may end up ordering it as anyway and just testing it and comparing it to the DJI Phantom, but I was a little bit leery, and where I have, you know, critical job, I've got to get this done, I decided that I better go the safe route. So that's kind of my story for this week of starting my photography business here locally. So far we are at $0, but hopefully by the end of this week I should have shot a couple houses at about, you know, $150 each house, between $150 and I think $215 was my high, depending on what package they want for those houses. So that's my update.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Your website, did you go start something new there, or did you use kind of what you had already?
I didn't make a website yet for real estate photography. I think when I am ready to do that, I'm going to make a completely separate website of just real estate photography, Meridian, Idaho, so that I can get a little bit of Google traffic, because there's so little competition for those keywords. I think I could rank in very short order.
Yeah.
And so I think in that case, it's going to be smart to make a separate website. Generally, I would recommend not starting a separate website for different aspects of your business, because now you don't have one website you want to rank on Google. You got two websites, and the hardest ranking factor to overcome is age. Google likes old websites. When your website is 5 years old, you can rank for whatever you want. When your website is 6 months old, good luck. Mm-hmm. It'll show up in rankings immediately, but to get up to number one and actually rank high, it just takes time. Google wants to see your website showing up, performing for a long time before they're going to rank it high. So generally, I don't recommend that. But in this situation where it's a very niche product and not a lot of competition, I am going to start a separate website.
So getting it set up and getting that fancy swiper stuff going, that would be good to talk about too then.
Yeah, definitely. That's definitely something I'd like to do. For now, I just set up the swiper thing just on improvephotography.com. I just used a page for that, but yeah, I will be building a website and I'll talk about how I'm doing that.
All right.
Very cool. Real estate's one of those areas where if you're in an area that really isn't flooded with other really good photographers, it's an area where a good photographer can really like set themselves apart in a hurry, because there's a lot of really, really bad real estate photography. HDR is like, real estate photography is kind of where all the HDR lovers go to like congregate and just do some of the grungiest of the grungy HDR. I'm not hating on HDR, but man, I've seen some really bad real estate photography out there. So yeah.
Yeah. And that's what I did with the before photos. It was really easy because we just bought this home. And so I just took the photos that were actually used to sell this house.
Oh, man.
And I showed, these are the actual photos that somebody tried to set to sell this home with. And then this is what I did with it. And now one thing, I'm sharing the photos that I don't have copyright to on this page. And so you have to be careful with copyright, of course, because mm-hmm. you're using somebody else's photo. But like, I guess this is like copyright 301, maybe, at least in the United States, there's something called fair use. And if you're showing a copyrighted work in order to critique it, you can do that. That's okay. You can do that under fair use. And so I'm showing the photo, I'm writing what things are wrong with it, and then I'm showing a critique of that photo. So that's how I'm doing that as far as copyright is concerned. But in terms of the marketing of it, I think it's pretty cool, pretty compelling thing to see that. And we'll put the link to this in the show notes, the page that I used. And now I just took these photos like in like literally an hour. So, you know,
don't be too harsh.
Maybe isn't my very best work. Don't be too harsh. But hey, focus on the marketing. Okay.
Nice.
What do you got for us this week, Nick?
So this week I actually booked a couple destination weddings. Well, one and a half destination weddings. The second one, it's not set in stone or anything yet, but I'm hoping it will be. So the first destination wedding is actually going to be in a cave. It's going to be in one of the Crystal Caverns in South Dakota, and I'm looking forward to it so, so hard. Basically, it's just going to be the bride, the groom, the officiant, and me, and in this large cavern. And I'm so very much looking forward to shooting that. Obviously, it's not going to be natural light. It's going to be pretty much all me. I think they've got some kind of ambient lighting set up in there just for the tours and stuff that happen there. So I'm hoping I'll be able to focus okay. But other than that, I'm going to be using my lights to light the whole thing. And so I'm going to be shooting the ceremony and then like an hour and a half of portraits afterwards. And then that's it. And it's going to be the coolest gig ever, because there's no mom, there's no dad, there's no like 50 cousins that I have to photograph. There's no family, there's no bridal party. It's just going to be bride and groom and epic photos. So I'm very much looking forward to that. And I've kind of been running through my head how I'm going to light this. And I've decided it's going to be a whole bunch of backlighting, because by backlighting, putting a flash back behind the couple and then shooting that back towards the camera, by doing that, I'm going to be casting lots of dramatic shadows, because there's going to be all kinds of textures on the walls and on the ceilings. And by backlighting it, it's really going to bring out all of that texture. I might need to do a little bit of reflector work just to give a little kiss of light back onto the couple. But for the most part, it's going to be like backlighting city, like lots of wide angle shots. I'm thinking, I just heard that Brent, my lens rental guy, is getting the new 11-24 from Canon. And I'm going to take that lens with me, because I think wide angle shots are just going to be so cool in a cavern like that. So very much looking forward to that one. It's going to be so much fun. The other destination wedding that might happen, I'm going to knock on wood. Hopefully I don't jinx this by talking about it, but it's going to be in Maui, which I hear is kind of nice.
That's rough.
Yeah, it's a rough gig, but I told him I'd do it, you know. kind of planning a trip like that is a little bit of a challenge because I've never been to Maui and I'm going to have to go there and try to find places to shoot. So in order to do that, I'm going to be looking on Scout. Scout is that program that we interviewed over on Portrait Session. It's a program. It's actually kind of a website just for photographers, mostly portrait photographers, and it helps them scout locations that they've never been to and help them find locations to go do shoots. So you can search in a particular area and find locations that people have shot there, and there's examples of what it looks like. So I'm going to be using that. I'm going to be using Google Earth a lot. That's how I scout for like all of my landscape photography. This isn't really a whole lot different. I'll be able to see, you know, where we're going to be on the island, and then I'll be able to kind of get ideas of where we could go and times of days, all that stuff. And an interesting feature in Google Earth that I don't know if a lot of people know about, but there's a little slider where you can actually change the time of day to show how the light is going to hit on that particular day. Like, and it shows.
Oh, they have that in Google Earth?
Yes. And it creates the shadows and stuff. It's kind of a hidden feature. I don't have it in front of me, but it's one of the things that you can turn on. It's probably up in the tools menu or options menu. But you can sit there and change the time of day and it shows you how the light falls. And it's not super accurate. It's not going to show you like exactly how the light's going to be on that particular day in 2017 or 16 or whatever, but it gives you an idea. That's kind of my thought process when I'm going to a new place like this, is trying to find places to shoot for the time of day and where the light's going to be and all that fun stuff. Yeah. So
they're letting you pick the location where the wedding's going
to
be?
No, their wedding will be somewhere, but when it comes to doing the portraits that I want to do, like generally if the location of the wedding sucks, I take them somewhere cool. So yeah, okay. Yeah, as long as it's somewhere fairly close, and you know, Maui, I'm sure we'll be able to find somewhere fairly photogenic. I would like to think that I can find a photogenic location on Maui, but if I can find somewhere that's, you know, a 10-minute drive or something, it's totally worth it because, you know, after the ceremony, before the reception. Okay, well, island weddings, they're not the typical wedding with the huge wedding party afterwards. Typically, they don't have a whole lot of friends that are going to fly all the way to Maui. It's going to be a smaller wedding. A lot of times you can do your ceremony, and then while everybody else goes and sits down and starts to have dinner or drink or whatever, I can steal the couple for a few minutes, take them somewhere really cool, do some hopefully really cool photography, and then bring them back to the party, and then they get announced. So that's kind of how I'm going to try to work that. But anyways, yeah, caverns. How cool is that to do a wedding in a cave? And apparently it's a crystal cave. So I assume there's going to be like stalagmites and stalactites and all kinds of cool.
You going to try any gels?
I could. Like the cool part of this particular wedding is that I'm not going to have any time constraints. It's basically like they're paying for me to be there for the ceremony and some portrait work afterwards. But I know that I'm going to be like, well, I've got a few more ideas. Let's just, and I'm going to go way over because that's such a cool portfolio opportunity. Like, how many wedding photos have you seen in caves? That's going to be a Nick Page signature piece right there. I'm really looking forward to it.
Puts the rings on a stalagmite.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. You are just baiting me with this because my doodad of the week is what you need for shooting in this cave. Like, this is perfect. It is called Atmosphere Aerosol. Have you guys heard about this?
No.
Like making a fake smoke kind of thing?
Mind blown when I saw this product. Like, I've seen all the photography products and so I'm just kind of bored by them now. Boom! Atmosphere aerosol is awesome. I saw somebody post about this on social media. I went to the website and within like 30 seconds, I was like, I'll take 3 cans. It's awesome. All right. So this is what it does. It's just an aerosol can, but no CFCs. It's environmentally friendly, okay. They tell me. It's just an aerosol can. And then when you want, like, if you're going to backlight something, you need some like some particles in the air to catch the light so that you can actually see those little booms of light.
Yeah.
Kaboom! You just spray the aerosol everywhere and bam! It's just got immediate... it's great. It's like right now in my office, there's fog everywhere and you can see the light beams.
That is so glorious.
It's absolutely glorious. It's unfortunately only available in the United States. It costs, I think, like $10, $15 per can. It didn't matter. It could have cost a million. I needed it. Okay. Just kidding. No, but I did need it. So this is awesome because I love shooting with the fog machine because you can actually, you know, get that look to the light. Mm-hmm. You can see the light, and this is just like a little fog machine that you can fit in your pocket.
It's awesome.
So it's inexpensive. It's got to come ground. One real problem with it is you cannot ship it air, and you cannot take it with you, even in a checked bag, when you are flying.
Explode.
And so if you're going in the United, because it's made of like propane and butane, and then like just olive oil. So it's like,
wow,
you know, you really just don't want to bring this with you. But I'm going to be ordering them to wherever I go in the United States because this is awesome. Even for like a landscape, if it's a kind of a little bit of a smaller area and it's not too windy, you could totally use this. I saw some awesome shots. You know, if you're getting like little bits of the trees and stuff and you're like, how about some light filtering between these trees?
Yeah.
That's so great. It's awesome.
Anyway, that would be my doodad of the week.
So my first question would
be... I've been excited about that.
My first question would be, how flammable is this stuff?
Yeah.
Is it super flammable?
Probably a lot. I've got to say it's probably a lot flammable. Hey, look at this. Danger. Highly flammable aerosol. Keep out of reach of children. Wow. Read label before use, pressurized container, may burst if heated. Do not spray on or near open flame or other ignition source. Take precautionary measures against static discharge. Turn off pilot lights, heaters, electric motors, and other sources of ignition. May be harmful if swallowed. May make floor slick if concentrated in one area. Can kill Nick Page if lighter.
I should definitely drag that stuff into a cave and then hit it with a bunch of lights, bunch of really cheap speed lights that throw sparks anyways. Oh, I'm so going to die. But I think I am going to buy a couple of those because that is so perfect. I'm not going to be able to take a smoke machine or a smoke bomb down there. So
no. I'm telling you, you're going to go to the website and you're going to say, I'll take three. It's awesome.
That's so cool.
And how cool would it be with the blue gel there? Blue light on that. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That would really make the mood.
All right. You know what else would be cool? Is some Valorette photography gloves. Is it like that segue? So that's my doodad this week. It's the Valorette photography gloves. It was Jim's doodad several weeks ago. And when he talked about it, I went and checked them out. And then I got a pair. And they are really nice. I used to use the Aquatech gloves. I like the Valorette ones better. They have really sticky palms. That way, when you're changing lenses and stuff, you can actually grip your equipment. And they have cool pocket on the front of the glove for like lens wipes and SD cards. And I just really, really like them. They're the Valorette. And I think I'm pronouncing it correctly. It may be Valorette photography gloves.
I have no idea how to do it. But the company's been way cool. They sent me the gloves when they were doing their Kickstarter and sent them to you as well. It seems like a really cool company. They're in Norway, is that right?
Yeah, I want to say Norway. And Norwegians, they know their cold weather. So
that's right.
They do.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Valorette photography gloves, I like them. They're my new favorite gloves for photography. I used to use the Aquatech ones, but these are better. So yeah, that's my doodad this week.
The Swedish may know their fish, but those Norwegians, they know their gloves.
Oh boy.
All right, Jeff, what do you got for us?
Okay, so I'm in the midst of doing my testing of mice for photo editing, trying to find the best photo editing mouse for both Mac and PC. So the Apple Magic Mouse will be in the running. I have a whole bunch of them in. not everybody, I asked for a whole bunch of vendors to send them to me, and not everyone is electing to participate in the competition here, but
so they lose.
I should have some good feedback. There's a couple of things I want to find out. I want to find out if a gaming mouse matters, because there's been lots of people who've sworn by that there's a gaming mouse can make a huge difference. But the other thing that I was really skeptical of was saying getting a good quality mouse pad makes a big difference too. I thought, no, come on, that's that's not going to make much of a difference. A mouse pad. A lot of these mice are built to work without even having a mouse pad there. But I decided I needed to try it. People have been telling me it makes a difference, so I went and got a really cheap one from Amazon. It's called the SteelSeries QCK Gaming Mouse Pad, and I got the little one, and it's huge. It's really, really big. So they have like four sizes, and I got the smallest. For photo editing, I don't think you need a really, really big one. I guess gamers maybe need something bigger. But the thing is, it has made a difference on how well the mouse glides. So it's not helping, I don't think, the pointer accuracy or anything like that. It just makes it so that it's easier to physically move the mouse around. And it's making it so that I have less wrist fatigue as I do it. I've had that a lot, where if I'm editing for a couple of hours at a time, boy, my wrist really just bothers me, and I needed to go take a break. And now that I've had this mouse pad, I haven't changed the mouse yet. I'm going to be doing that soon, but I'm using the same mouse, and that's because I wanted to see the effect of the mouse pad. I'm really impressed. It does a good job of making it so that it is just physically easier to move the mouse around, and there's less wrist fatigue. So that's the SteelSeries.
So are you using a wrist pad with this?
No.
That's probably why your wrists are hurting.
No. I had that before. So I had one. I had one that there was a wrist pad there, and it was like a really cheap. I don't know how to describe it, but it was really a junky mouse pad thing that had a wrist pad thing. And I was very skeptical, like I said, that if I got this little mat, that it would make any difference. I like it better than even having the wrist pad there. It makes it move very smoothly on the surface of that pad. So,
oh, very cool. Well, see, Nick baited me with atmosphere aerosol. I was going to save this for another episode, but you know when you can just pop a top and spray anytime you want. Anyway, now you're baiting me with this. I'm going to waste all my doodads on this episode. Just this week, I also bought a mouse pad, and I love it as well. I've always used a mouse pad, but this one is, it's okay. First of all, the name of it, it's called the Glorious Extended White Gaming Mouse Mat. So it's huge. Let's see, 36 inches long, which is, oh, I don't know, it's about a meter, I would guess. It's pretty long. And then, you know, a meter by maybe a third of a meter,
yeah.
You know, 36 inches by one foot. So it's really big, extends pretty long on your desk. And then I also have a wrist pad. But the nice thing about it is it kind of keeps my keyboard from clunking on my desk as I'm typing as well. Yeah. And then you can move the mouse anywhere along a really big area. I really like this, but I also use an actual pad to go under my mouse, a wrist pad, because if I don't have that wrist pad, man, it kills my wrist. So anyway, that's what I'm using. But this, it said it was glorious. How do you not buy that when it says it's glorious?
I
don't know.
I think the name of mine sounds like it beats yours up, takes us lunch money. So
what was your, the SteelSeries
QCK.
Yeah, beat that. Little, I think you may have me, Jeff.
It's only $10, so you know it's worth the try for people if they want to give it a shot. $10, see if it makes a difference for you. I really love it.
All right, well, I'll check it out. Thanks everybody for joining us on this episode of the Improved Photography Podcast. We've had a lot of fun. Thank you for your download and your support of Improved Photography. I've been making it my goal to write every single day on Improved Photography a new article on the website. So be sure to check it out, kind of make that part of your morning routine when you're half awake in bed, checking blogs, trying to wake up so you don't go to sleep to your alarm clock. Go check improvephotography.com and read some of the stuff that we're writing there as well. We will see you in another 7 days.